We're going to be picking up in Daniel 11, and we have several visitors with us this morning. You may have a little bit of trouble. Hopefully, we can give enough background to bring you up to speed as to where we are in the chapter. Daniel's 10 through 12 consists of Daniel's last vision that he receives during the third year of the reign of Cyrus of the Medes and the Persian Empire. And this map goes here a long way in helping us really understand the events that are taking place in chapter 11. Chapter 10 was the arrival of the angel as it began to speak to Daniel. Chapter 11, where we're currently at, is the vision that Daniel receives from the angel. And chapter 12 is really going to conclude the chapter and the vision, and Daniel's told to seal up the vision for the days ahead. But here in chapter 11, to really understand a lot of what's taking place, it's really just a big broadcast of history. And this map helps us understand the things that are talked about in Daniel 11. This is the map during the days of Alexander the Great from the Greek Empire. And as he died at a very young age, four rulers essentially arose after his death to claim the territory in the Greek Empire. And you can kind of see there broken down, or maybe you can on the map, the largest portion there is the seaweed green looking color. That was what's known as the Seleucid Empire. And the other that we're primarily concerned about there down in the southwest is Egypt. That's kind of the darker green that you see down there. That's possessed, that's held by the dynasty or the kingdom called the Ptolemies. And that little red J that you see right there, that's Jerusalem. And that's the significance of Daniel chapter 11. Why it is that God is revealing the history between these two warring kingdoms, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, is because so much of that is having an impact and having an effect on God's people at Jerusalem. You can kind of see that right there. This is a very contentious area. They're going back and forth, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Back and forth, warring over that particular possession of land. And so there's going to be a lot of uproar, and there's going to be a lot of backlash from those two nations fighting that's going to impact God's people. And so that's really why we have chapter 11 here. So we'll pick up in the middle of the chapter, verses 5 through 10. Kyle, would you read that text for us? We talked a little bit about it this week, got a few more things to say, and then we'll move on in the chapter. Verses 5 through 10. All right, so verses 5 through 10, kind of, we looked at this a little bit last week. Now, if you're reading this, or if you've read through Daniel chapter 11, you're probably wondering, this is very confusing. And you're right, we're going to try to look at this just as concisely as possible, hitting the high points. But there's a lot of things there that we probably don't appreciate the same way the people that read this after Daniel would. We look back at history, and we match the things that Daniel says with the things that have taken place. But as Daniel wrote these things, it wouldn't be until about 300 years later that the things that Daniel writing with very accurate specifics come to pass between these two warring portions of the Greek Empire, that is the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Now, when you read these two terms, the king of the north, the king of the south, we're going to be looking at a lot of time. Probably 150 years is going to be taking place of history between those two kingdoms in chapter 11. And so we're going to be looking at multiple kings rising and falling, and it's not always real clear in the text whenever we go from talking about one king to another who's died and his son has risen up and is now reigning as king. I'll make those distinctions as we travel along through the text, but it's not always real clear. And so as you're reading through this, you're probably having trouble matching all of this together. We'll just kind of take a historical overview of all that's happening, and I'll explain the distinctions as they take place along the way. So we talked a little bit about verse 5 last week, and as you begin to read verses 5 and 6, you sense somewhat of this marital alliance that begins to take place in verses 5 and 6. King of the South, you hear those two terms, the King of the South and the King of the North, that's to distinguish between what we've identified as really this Egyptian portion of the Greek kingdom and the greater portion of the Greek kingdom possessed by the Seleucids. So, King of the South, Egypt, King of the North, Seleucids. So just keep those in mind, as that's the language that's used to make the distinction between these two empires. So they make this attempt at this marital alliance in verses 5 and 6. King of the South at this time is Ptolemy the First. He is one of the generals of Alexander the Great. And then King of the North of the Seleucids is Prince Seleucus Nicator. We're not going to get too involved with the specifics. You can go back if you're interested and read about the history. We just kind of want to hit the major points. Really how Nicator Seleucus got his power, you can see he possesses the greater portion, and my little laser is going to need its battery replaced. The greater portion of the Grecian Empire belonged to Seleucus. Initially, as another of Alexander's generals, he sided with Ptolemy. But Ptolemy designated and sent him out to kind of take control of this northern portion of the Grecian Empire, and as a result of sending him there, he really grew greater than Ptolemy. You can see that the possession of land that he has is much larger than that Ptolemy possessed. And if you look at verse 5, it kind of makes this point. The king of the south will grow strong. It's talking about Ptolemy the First, along with one of his princes. That's Seleucus Nicator. Continuing on in verse 5, it says, one of his princes is going to gain ascendancy over him and attain dominion. His domain will be great dominion indeed. And as you can tell geographically, just by looking at the two portions of the Ptolemies and Seleucids, the prince that initially sided with Ptolemy, that was sent to reign in this greater portion of Greece, he gained a domain, and his domain became greater than that of the king of the south. And you continue on reading in verse 6, after some years, they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful agreement. So you see there this marital alliance taking place. So this angel, as it's speaking to Daniel and as it's revealing these things, is giving a brief overview of the history that's going to take place between these two kingdoms. Verses 5 and 6, between those two verses, a great number of years have passed. And we don't really gather the sense as we read. We gather perhaps some time has passed. But in verse 6, you've got a new king. That's king of the north and king of the south. Some 35 years have passed. And there's a lot of warring that's going on between these two. And as they strive for peace, they try to bring that peace about, accomplishing it through this marital alliance. And so at this point in time, in verse 6, you've got Ptolemy's son, goes by the name Ptolemy Philadelphus of the south, and Antiochus the second. So we've transitioned kings between verses 5 and 6. You got different kings that are on the throne. Antiochus the second of the north, that is of the Seleucid Empire, previously in his marriage he had exiled his wife. He had a child with this woman, but he exiled his wife and his child and he sent them away. And so then what they seek to do is they seek to capitalize on this situation and bring somewhat of an alliance between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And so the king of the south offers his daughter, who we famously know as Cleopatra, to marry the king of the north. And so actually, I'll take that back. That detail doesn't come along until later. I apologize. Her name is Bernice. So there's going to be another marital alliance that takes place later that we'll talk about involving Cleopatra. But the king of the south gives his daughter Bernice to Antiochus II in hopes of forming this alliance between them. Well, he takes her, he marries her, they have a child. What he does, however, is he reconciles with his wife that he had previously exiled. And, you know, we have this little phrase that we use, something to the effect, there's no fury of that of a woman scorned. And that's essentially manifested as we see Antiochus II, shortly after he brings his wife and his child that he exiled initially back and takes them as his family and kind of discards Bernice, that is the woman he took in this alliance, off to the side. He ends up dying of poisoning. And of course, they're going to expect and they're going to blame the wife that was kind of shunted off to the side. So as a result of that, there are those within the kingdom that kill Bernice and kill her child, along with much of her Egyptian contours and her Egyptian servants that were sent along over with her. And you look at verse 6 and you read this. After some years, there's going to form an alliance. The king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. That's the marriage. She, Bernice, will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power. But she will be given up along with those who brought her in and the one who sired her, as well as the one who supported her in those times. And so what you see after you read that is this attempt to bring these two, the unity to among the division that exists, essentially failed. She's not going to maintain her power. She's shunted off to the side, and she's ultimately killed by the Seleucids because she was accused of poisoning, killing the current king. So there's some cryptic language here, but Bernice is not going to succeed in bringing the peace that was sought after by these two dynasties. So we need to stop here for a moment before we continue on and talk briefly about what's called or what's referred to as the Syrian Wars. To really understand the verses that are going to be following, we need to take a moment to talk about this. And I know it feels a lot like a history class, but we do need to go into a little bit of detail, and it'll make the following verses make a lot more sense. And we're going to go through this very quickly. There are six Syrian wars that took place over about 150 years between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, the king of the south and the king of the north. The first war was Ptolemy II against Antiochus I, and essentially Antiochus I was seeking to just simply expand his empire. And so they go to war, and you're going to see a lot of bickering and a lot of fighting taking place between these two dynasties, essentially until they're absorbed into the Roman Empire. But as Antiochus sought to expand his rule into Syria, once again, that portion of the map that we had, he's trying to expand his rule, kind of gain control of that area there where the Jews are at. As he seeks to expand, he goes to war, he's rebuffed, he isn't successful in his attempt. And so the Ptolemies have this temporary victory. The second war takes place, and you can see there the dates of those, 260 to 253, 7 years. It's Ptolemy II, same king of the south, versus Antiochus II. Essentially what happened, they're going to seek to expand their reign again. So the Seleucids, they go and they get these allies, and then they once again attack and they try to take control of the area of Syria. They essentially, remember, this one was dissolved, this war came to an end, and they try to bring peace about by the marriage that was discussed in verses 5 and 6 between Antiochus II and Bernice, which obviously failed. And of course, as it's to no one's surprise, that leads to, after the death of Bernice, that leads to what's known as the Third Syrian War between Ptolemy II and Antiochus's heir, Seleucus II. They do manage to reach peace after warring for 5 years. Okay. War number 5, Ptolemy IV versus Antiochus III. Antiochus III, also known as Antiochus the Great, once again seeks to regain that former glory his empire possessed. And he's trying to take advantage of the circumstances that are taking place down in Egypt. Ptolemy IV is a relatively young king. And so he thinks, now is a good opportunity for me to go to war and to expand. A king that doesn't have much experience in serving in this role or in battle, now is a good time for me to do this. However, he is once again rebuffed, and that Syrian area remains in control of the Ptolemies. Fifth war, Ptolemy the fourth successor, and Antiochus the third, once again Antiochus the Great. As Ptolemy V really came into power, came into the throne, kind of like King Josiah, he came in at a very young age. And so since I think he was 5 years old when he took the throne in Egypt. And so once again, Antiochus the Great says, this is an opportunity for me to take advantage of the situation. Egypt, when it was in a state of near anarchy, and he realized the potential that was taking place there between them. And so he takes advantage of the opportunity that's presented itself, and he attacks. However, before he can take control, and he's well on his way to doing so, Rome steps in. And Rome says, hey, you need to get out of here. And Rome's really becoming powerful at this point in time. And so once again, he complies with the demand, but he kind of continued to raid. And he did end up taking, finally, control of Syria. And we'll talk about that a little more. It's detailed for us in the following verses. We're just laying a little bit of foundation groundwork. The last war that took place was the sixth war between Ptolemy the VI and Antiochus the IV. Now, we've talked a lot about Antiochus the IV way back in chapter 8, and he's going to be the center of verses 21 through 45, which we'll look at later in the chapter. Antiochus the IV essentially goes to war in response to some actions that were taken by the Egyptians. He takes this strategic town, and Egypt really realizes the circumstances that they're in. So, recognizing the mistake that they made, they try to settle. They give the area of Syria finally over to the Seleucids. And what Antiochus the IV is going to do is he says, okay, you know, we'll sign your treaty. We'll sue for peace. But what we're going to do, you send one of your kings or your princes over here with me. And so essentially he takes one of the princes under his wing. He sends him back to Egypt to rule, thinking, okay, if I've had influence on this prince, I'm going to send him back. Essentially, I've got control in Egypt now. However, back in Egypt, there was a revolt. They said, you know, we know what you're trying to do. And they named another one of the royal lineage as king and said, no, you're not going to send this guy down to reign over us. We know what you're after. Before Antiochus could really step in and stomp the rebellion that was taking place in Egypt, we have the Maccabean revolt that we've talked about and that we'll talk a little more about as we proceed in the text. He had to go back to the area of Judea and really deal with that Maccabean revolt and stop those Jews that were beginning to rebel in the area. However, the side effect of that was these two Ptolemy brothers, they renewed their relationship. They straightened themselves back out. They decide they don't want to serve under Antiochus anymore, and they make their relationship good again. And so Antiochus loses control of Egypt. And that's really going to have a negative impact on the Jews, as we're going to find out from reading. Once again, he continues to make war, having lost that power and that influence. Rome steps in one final time, and this is the last Syrian war. Rome steps in one final time and says, you're not going to take control of this area. You see, Egypt was very, very fertile land, and being the breadbasket that it was, being so rich in grain and in wealth, and funding much of Rome's army and Rome's wealth, Rome said, you're not going to mess with Egypt. Leave Egypt alone. And so they essentially gave Antiochus the IV an ultimatum and say, you're going to start war with us if you continue to attack Egypt. And so finally, once and for all, he backs off, and that's really the last wars that go on between these two nations. That ends about 168 B.C. Now, we said all of that because from this point forward in the text through about verse 21, as the angel speaking to Daniel and making this revelation known, it's pointing to various things that occurred at some point in time between the history of these two nations, the warring that's taking place. So now that we've given really the detail there, we can make a little more sense of that as it's happened. So from this point forward, what the angel talks about is going to fit somewhere in here between these six Syrian wars. So all the while that this is happening, guess who's stuck in the middle of things? Well, it's Jerusalem. And so that's a large part of why what we have here is recorded for us. And as the Jews are wondering, okay, what's going to happen to us as a nation? Is the fighting that's going on between these two going to just demolish us? Or is there ever going to be peace? Daniel brings this revelation, or the angel brings this revelation to Daniel, who in turn we find answers this question. So verses 7 through 9, as we read through that, just very quickly, you'll notice the detail as it points back to the previous wars. one of the descendants of her line. And remember, this is the failed marriage that took place between the King of the South, the King of the North, with Bernice, the daughter of the King of the South, being murdered by the people of the North, the Seleucids. One of her descendants, the descendants of her line, will arise in her place. He's talking about her brother. And he will come against the army. He'll enter the fortress of the King of the North, and he will deal with them, and he will display great strength. The God, their gods with metal images and precious vessels of silver and gold, he will take into captivity into Egypt, and he on his part will refrain from attacking the King of the North for some years. And then the latter will enter the realm of the King of the South, but will return to his own land. So this refers to an event that took place during the Third Syrian War. Ptolemy the Third, a brother of Bernice that was murdered, a branch of her roots, as the text here describes, he invades the Seleucid Empire, and he took a lot of the treasure. We read there, he took some of the gods that were there, verse 8, their metal images, their precious vessels of silver and gold. And you'll think back to Israel's history. Sometimes whenever a nation was victorious over Israel, particularly what comes to mind is the Philistines. Whenever the Philistines, during the days of Eli, defeated the Israelites, do you remember what they took as, right, they took the Ark of the Covenant. What that demonstrates is their, in their minds, the superiority of their God who had given them victory over their enemies. So they took the Ark of the Covenant back to the land of Philistia, much to their regret, which they eventually end up trying to send back because of the disease and the anger that breaks out against the Lord, against the people. However, that was just a common practice. Whenever you went to war with another nation, you defeated them, you took their gods. And you kind of did that to demonstrate the superiority of your God. But that's the event that's kind of being described in verses 7 through 9. However, verse 10, his sons will mobilize and will assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through, that he may wage war up to this very fortress. Okay, the son that's referred to is probably one of the more successful, although not as well biblically known, kings of the Seleucids. That's Antiochus III, Antiochus the Great. His father of Antiochus IV, who's going to cause all of the trouble for the Jews. And so he reigns over this Seleucid dynasty for some 30 years or so. And it said this king of the north would wage war up to his very fortress. What it's talking about here is Antiochus III's capture of one of the Egyptian strongholds called Seleucia. So that's what that essentially is describing there. In verse 10. Let's go ahead and read a little more in our text. Jim, would you read verses 11 through 19 for us?
And the king of the south shall be moved with rage to go out and fight with him, the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. King of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. Now in those times many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. After this he shall turn his face to the coastlands, and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall, and not be found.
A couple verses at a time. Going back to verses 11 and 12. King of the south will be enraged and go forth, and fight with the king of the north. No surprise there, that's been going on for some 50 years at this point in time. The latter will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be given into the hand of the former. When the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cause tens of thousands to fall, yet he will not prevail. This is describing a war that took place between Ptolemy IV and Antiochus III were able to easily identify as what's called the Battle of Raphia. Both of these armies had gathered troops, about 70,000, and they gathered their war elephants and their navies and all of these men, and they're going to go to war in the Battle of Raphia. Both of these armies suffered defeat. However, as we read through the text, as this angel is speaking and talking a little bit about the details here, the latter is going to raise this great multitude, but the multitude, end of verse 11, will be given into the hand of the former. So this is going to be a victory for the king of the south. He only lost a few thousand men in this battle. However, as verse 11 dictated, being given into the hand of the former, that's the king of the south, Antiochus III lost nearly 20,000 men in this particular battle. That phrase that's used, he will cause tens of thousands to fall. Antiochus suffered the loss of some 20,000 soldiers. And so after this defeat, he returns back to Gaza. He issues a formal sue for peace, a formal acknowledgement of defeat, and he goes back home. Now, despite winning the battle, the king of the south did not press his advantage in this particular circumstance. He was content to simply allow things remain as they previously were. You look at the end of verse 12 there. When the multitude's carried away, his heart will be lifted up. He will cause tens of thousands to fall. That's the king of the south's victory, yet he will not prevail. New King James says he was not strengthened by his victory. And so rather than pressing his advantage and expanding his empire and taking some of the Seleucid territory, he was content to allow things to return simply as they were. Although he won the battle and caused thousands of his enemies to fall, he will not prevail. He was not strengthened by this victory. Verses 13 and 14 continue to continue on, and it describes an event that takes place some 14 years later. Once again, Antiochus the Great, the king of the north, makes this attempt at conquering the portion that belonged to the king of the south. And the second invasion, what prompted the second invasion was the death of Ptolemy the Fourth, and that's where the young king of the south, 5 years old, comes on to the throne. Antiochus takes advantage of the things that were taking place. In verse 14, the phrase that's used, in those times many will rise up against the king of the south. And so he raised this great army. What he did was he enlisted help from Philip of Macedon. So you can tell, once again, four portions of the Greek, this Macedonian province up there, king of the north enlists the help of Philip V of the Macedonians to once again go and to war for this desirable area of Syria. Many will rise up against the king of the south. And so he raises this greater army, he attacks, and looks like he's going to have some success. Now, we see a little bit of the involvement from the Jews in verse 14. The angel speaks to Daniel, in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south. The violent ones among your people will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. And so he's talking about some of the Jews that were dissatisfied with the reign of the Ptolemies and are seeking to throw off their yoke of bondage, and they side with the Seleucids. However, as Daniel dictates here, rather the angel dictates here, they're going to fall in their attempt to throw off the bondage of the Seleucids. Let's see if we can take these last couple of verses 15 and 16. The king of the north will come, cast up a siege ramp, capture a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even the choicest troops, for there will be no strength to stand. And so that's the siege of the city of Sidon that was eventually won by Antiochus III. The king of the south will not stand their ground. And so they end up losing that particular battle. In verse 16, the king of the north, he who comes against him will do as he pleases. He'd be successful in that endeavor. No one will be able to withstand him, and he will stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand. So after taking victory over this Syrian province somewhat, Antiochus III is going to stay there in the land of Jerusalem. And as you read this, you kind of get the idea that he's going to make war, or make trouble for the Jews. The last part of verse 16, he's going to remain in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand. not so much talking about war that he's going to make on the Jews. That's going to come by his heir, Antiochus the Fourth, on the Jews. Rather, what that phrase more accurately means is he has the power to destroy these people. Because he went to war, he took control of this portion of Syria. They're in his hand. If he wants to destroy them, all he's got to do is give the word, and he can destroy them. So destruction's in his hand. He has the power to bring about the end of the people. However, that wasn't what he was going to do. But he did finally wrest control of this Syrian portion away from the Ptolemies, as verse 16 tells us that he was going to do. All right, I know that's a lot of history. And we've got a little bit more in front of us as we continue on through chapter 11. It's my full intention to finish chapter 11 next week. I know that's a lot of verses, but when we get to verses 21 to 25, 45, it's going to be talking about Antiochus the Fourth. We really talked about him in great detail in chapter 8, so we're not going to spend just a whole lot of time looking at the things that are rehashed for us here in regard to him. But I know that's a lot of information to take in, and I do apologize. The only alternative, as I see it, to gloss over this is to just not talk about it and just skip the text. However, we do need to understand it as it is a part of God's inspired word, but I know it's a lot of information. Are there any comments, any questions, anything that need further explanation regarding the history of these two kingdoms within the Greek Empire that we want to address in this class? Miss Johnny?
In verse 15, that cannibal came into the picture there, helping to lose the king.
Okay.
You know, if you read about him in history,
mm-hmm.
This is when his part was.
Okay. I didn't come across anything by that in my study, but I do know that, as we read previously, the king of the north was going to raise up this greater army, and he was going to enlist help from others. And so you're saying that was one of the allies that he enlisted as he sought to take over Egypt?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Hannibal's probably a name that we've all heard of before, as we remember some of those boring history classes, and you're probably wondering, why in the world am I having to go through this again? But he's a name that we'll recall probably from our history class. Miss Johnny said that that Antiochus, king of the north, enlisted his help to make war on the Jews, and in turn that alliance kind of helped turn the tide of the battle, because we see he took that portion of Syria. He had the power to destroy it as he relinquished control finally from the Ptolemies. So any other comments, questions on the text?